medically, a stroke is a disorder, a problem of the blood vessels in the brain. Whether a hemorrhage with a rupture of the blood vessel or a rupture of an aneurysm with bleeding around the brain, the most common type of stroke is an ischemic or a lack of blood flow stroke, where a blood clot or a blockage of an artery causes an interruption of blood flow to the brain, then producing neurologic symptoms for a period of time. If that goes on permanently and causes a lasting disability, then that's a stroke. There are other types of lack of blood flow that are not permanent or that are more fleeting, less lasting, and those are called transient ischemic attacks. And those are really at times just as malignant as a completed stroke can be. Many strokes are preceded or heralded by a transient ischemic attack, probably at least 15 to 20% of the time. And so that's really an opportunity when patients need to know sort of the warning signs and symptoms of stroke, what things that they need to go to acute medical intervention to try to keep the process from continuing and causing permanent disability or damage.
So you're talking about an attack that may occur that may be an indication of a stroke or major stroke to come.
Correct. There are different risk factors for whether hemorrhagic or ischemic stroke. Certainly one of the more prevalent ones is hypertension, but also diabetes with problems with blood sugar, high cholesterol, obesity, physical inactivity, and there are other non-modifiable risk factors that we can't treat, like your age, your sex, your family history, who your parents were, and those sorts of things. You know, we all carry with us as difficulties, but don't have medical treatments to change those at this point in time.
Which begs the question then, is stroke preventable?
Stroke is very preventable. We have, on average, over 700,000 strokes every year occurring in the United States. If you look at all strokes, both new and recurrent, that number goes up to almost 795,000. Stroke's the fourth leading cause of death in the country, behind heart disease, chronic lung disease, and cancer.
Why so many?
It goes back to, at times, a lack of preventative medicine for some patients, risk factors that are not being modified well enough, and then some factors that are unforeseen and can't be helped. You know, for many patients, whether they come in with a transient ischemic attack, which may only last 10 to 20 minutes and then go away, or that patient that acutely starts to have symptoms that aren't going away, we know that stroke in this day and age really is a medical emergency. Just like if you have a blockage in a heart vessel and a myocardial infarction or a heart attack, stroke really is a brain attack. It's a need, when symptoms are identified immediately, to call 911, to go urgently to the emergency room. Don't wait to see your doctor. Don't wait to get into the car and drive in someplace. But 911, the pre-hospital ambulance picks the patient up with the paramedics and immediately brings them. And we're fortunate enough in Dallas-Fort Worth to have a variety of stroke networks as well as stroke facilities where patients can be taken to for appropriate care.
And the number of stroke facilities has increased over the years from what it used to be. Is there a reason behind that?
Well, there's several reasons. One has been, starting in the mid-90s, we had a variety of new medications that were actually enzymes that the body normally produces that we give, one called tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA, which is thought of as the clot-busting or clot-dissolving medication that we can give to these patients with blockages of arteries or blood clots to try to restore the normal blood flow. If I look at all patients that we generally treat with the medication, back at the studies as well as our own experience, at least 12 to 13% of anyone we touch with the medication is made better, having little or no symptoms of a stroke after maybe coming in with a very severe disabling appearing stroke at onset.
When a stroke occurs, well, first of all, how would you recognize it?
The common signs and symptoms of stroke are weakness or numbness involving the face or arm or leg, difficulty with speaking or confusion, difficulty understanding or expressing language, a incoordination, balance, or gait walking difficulty, a loss of vision, which can occur in one or both eyes, as well as sometimes signaling more a hemorrhagic stroke, the sudden onset of a very severe or explosive headache. These sort of five symptoms are what we think of as stroke warning signs and symptoms. And if patients have these, we recommend they call 911, because especially for those with the ischemic, the lack of blood flow type of stroke, for those patients having a cerebral infarction, we, for all patients, have up to 3 hours, for select patients up to 4.5 hours, to give them the IV TPA intravenously, to give this drug in the emergency department. Many things have to happen in terms of being picked up by EMS, dropped at the emergency department, have a CAT scan, labs to check to make sure there's not an extra bleeding risk, and then a specialist be brought in, like a cardiologist or a neurologist for stroke, to basically decide on giving the drug and proceeding forward.
But this all needs to happen within a window of about 3 hours or so?
Within a window of about 3 hours. And, you know, with any patient, you know, if they identify symptoms at home, there's going to be a lag time in terms of calling 911, the ambulance, going to the house, stabilizing the patient, bringing them into the emergency room. So what we look at nationally as well as at Baylor Dallas is to try to optimize the treatment so that the majority of our patients are receiving the tissue plasminogen activator, if they're appropriate for that, within an hour, so that by the time they hit our emergency room door, to the time to where we have the IV and the drug, so what we call door-to-needle time, is a goal of 60 minutes. And that's a national goal that's set up by American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, and a variety of other national bodies. And at Baylor Dallas, we have continued to increase the proportion of patients that are meeting that goal of door-to-needle within an hour. Mm-hmm. And as of last year, we're almost a 40%.
Can you have a stroke and not know it?
Oh, absolutely. That does happen at times. And what happens with many patients is whether they're afraid of what the symptoms might portend or hold, whether they, with stroke, have cognitive difficulties. We're talking about the mind and the brain being involved. So, you know, when one family member looks to the stroke victim and goes, "Are you feeling okay? Is this dizziness or is this incoordination or speaking problem something serious?" Well, they may not be the right person to actually be making that decision, impaired cognitively by having an acute stroke. And so the lack of knowledge within the patient population, within the community, of the urgency at times, as well as the varied symptoms with stroke, really do hamper us in terms of getting the patient enough, quickly enough, into the emergency room for appropriate treatment. Stroke as a brain attack is different than cardiac disease and a heart attack, because for many times when someone is having a heart attack, it's a more homogeneous, it's a more simplified clinical spectrum, chest pain, pain maybe rating up to the jaw, down the arm, feeling nauseous, having sweatiness.
More people are aware of that,
and there's pain involved too. For a stroke, many strokes may occur upon awakening, so patients wake up from a nap or from sleeping the night before and have new onset of symptoms. Well, did I sleep on my arm wrong? Is this, you know, just a nerve problem or something else? Or what does this really portend?
So it could be easy to dismiss.
Sometimes it is very easy to dismiss.
Is there such a thing as a tip, as a profile of a typical stroke victim?
Many the patients that are at highest risk for having a stroke are generally those patients that are middle-aged to elderly. So your prevalence in the population, the percentage of patients that have an increased risk of stroke, while those percentages when you're in your 20s and 30s are certainly much under 5%, the risk of a stroke, as we look at every 10-year decade beyond the age of 40, 45, actually doubles. And so also what happens along that lines is you've had your chronic medical illnesses, whether it's been chronic smoking or diabetes, difficulties with hypertension or high cholesterol, certain heart illnesses.
Then your chances are greater.
Your chances are greater.
Which then begs the question, do lifestyle choices have a great impact on whether or not you may have a stroke?
Oh, they actually do. And when we look at what risk factors we can modify, many of those risk factors, whether it's diabetes and keeping your blood sugar under control and what you eat and how you manage your diabetes, because certainly uncontrolled diabetes portends a higher risk of stroke, whether it's high blood pressure Are we dropping weight? Are we on a salt-restricted or salt-controlled diet? Are we exercising regularly to keep our blood pressures down? And are we appropriately taking our medications and following up to make sure that our blood pressure is more adequately controlled? With cholesterol, there are certain drugs as well as diet that make a great impact there. Mm-hmm. So we see across the country, looking at this as a national health issue, that there is a stroke belt, that there are certain states, usually the southern, southeastern states from sort of North Carolina wrapping around the Gulf states to Louisiana, that have a higher percentage, higher incidence, even higher mortality in stroke than other areas of the country.
Why and a is lot
of
that?
Well, some of that may be lifestyle, maybe diet. Whether there are certain areas that may have a greater aging population as well. There are probably different public health factors all involved that relate to that.
I suspect many people think of stroke and think of afterwards loss of speech, loss of motor skills, what have you. If you have a stroke, can you reasonably expect quality of life after?
Every stroke is different. And when we look at stroke, we have different measures. We have different ways of examining the patient to try to help prognosticate and tell which patients are going to be, you know, better able to come back from their disabilities. Obviously, on a general average, if you have a smaller stroke than a larger stroke because of less brain geography being involved, you're less likely to have, you know, greater symptoms with a smaller stroke than another, unless it happens in a very elegant area of the brain. So every stroke is different and every stroke patient is different. Many stroke patients, at the time of onset of their symptoms, when they're in the emergency room, whether they're receiving the TPA or being admitted to the hospital if they've come in too late, are generally at the worst within that first several days. And then as we stabilize the patient going on using different rehabilitation measures with physical, occupational, and speech therapy, we then try to make inroads on reducing the disability. And recovery really after a stroke is a lifelong process. There's not a magic date that after you've had your stroke that you can expect that your recovery will stop. Most patients do make the majority of their inroads, the majority of their progress and improvement early on, but again, recovery from a stroke really is a lifelong issue.